It stars Ethan Hawke and Amanda Seyfried. And Ethan Hawke is a pastor with a rough backstory who lives in upstate New York. And
you could say he had a rough past.
No.
Or...
No, I can't. Can I quit this podcast now? Is that possible?
After a little bit of a layoff, that's kind of both of our faults, I guess. Having a job has made this a little more difficult, and time zones don't help. But I'm Chris, and I'm here with my co-host Zach. How are you?
It's weird that you have a job now. It's weird that you can't blame all these timing things on me and just only me. Now it's spread out between the two of us.
To be fair. You were to blame for basically everything beforehand.
I know this is an audio format, but I really wish people could see the terrible, terrible fedora that you're wearing right now. I feel like that should be mentioned specifically, and should not be, unremarked in this episode.
New year, new me, man.
You are wearing this in your own home while recording a audio podcast, just so everyone's clear.
It's comfortable, man.
Is it?
I wore it to the races the other day, and it felt good.
Who are you? What happened? You get a job, and now you're wearing fedoras and going to races all the time?
To be fair, it was my birthday weekend, and we were just kind of doing some stuff that sounded like fun. So the Del Mar racetrack, which is like half an hour north of where I am right now, is they do a summer concert series where if you pay like admission to get into the races, then you get a free concert, which is kind of cool.
Who's the concert?
So, Iration.
Never heard of
them.
They're
kind of like, they're like faux reggae, kind of pop reggae kind of stuff, which isn't really my cup of tea. But I will say, a lot of fun to go see live and like be around a bunch of people who do enjoy that and just be dancing around the whole time. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. So if you ever get a chance to go do that, go do that.
Yeah, there's something to be said for being around people at a concert that you don't necessarily love the band of, but know that everyone around you is having a good time. And it kind of, you know, bleeds into your own enjoyment a little bit more. So
weirdly, this was actually the second time I've seen them.
Why?
They were at a mini festival, opening for Wolf Mother, The Offspring, and Cheap Trick, which is the most random collection of artists.
All right, those are three bands that have technically existed. So sure.
For sure. I had way less fun the first time because it wasn't like that wasn't the vibe I was going for at that point, but
weird.
Good fun the second time.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to do the normal thing. We're going to talk about some movies, some TV, some music, and at the end we're going to briefly discuss some movies and music that we think have kind of been overlooked is kind of too strong of a word, but underappreciated might be a little bit better.
It's like pornography. You don't know how to describe it, but you know when you see it.
I love that you're citing a Supreme Court case right now. Pretty great. So yeah, I think underappreciated is more applicable for movies because these major release movies can't really fly quite as under the radar as an album can. Just because of the distribution ability for movies versus music. So, yeah, we've picked out a couple that we think are things we really enjoy that you may not have heard. So, but first, here are some mainstream movies. Yeah, here are some mainstream movies that have made millions and millions of dollars that you've definitely heard of.
The first, I'm not sure, is entirely mainstream just because of the genre in which it falls. And that one is Hereditary, which we've both seen. And we had a lot to talk about via text afterwards, but I think we both are in the same camp of really enjoying this film.
Yes. So this is a caveat to say that I don't love horror movies as a genre. There are a lot of people that do, and I can understand why they do. But I was pulled into this movie more from the fact that it was getting a bunch of rave reviews as a film and not a horror film, which I was intrigued by. I'm not a big fan of the jump scare, overly gory, either of those two camps of genre, or either of those two genres of horror film. But this was kind of the psychological tension building style, which I think I appreciate a little bit more.
Yeah, but based on your enjoyment of this film, I could recommend a few others for you that you would definitely like. And my enjoyment of horror films in general is mostly along the lines of not missing out on good films just because they're horror films. I wouldn't call myself a horror film buff or someone who particularly loves horror films, but I definitely have a little more of an appreciation than maybe your average movie viewer. Yeah, Zach is waving at me. This is a podcast, man, so just like my hat, can't see you waving. This reminded me of so many horror movies I've watched over the past 2 years. It had so many elements of all horror movies that I pretty much enjoyed. And I think it was at times both unique and original, but at the same time borrowing from a lot of established and well-reviewed horror movies. And I think it was very successful at doing that.
Yeah, so I think we're going to try and stay away from spoilers, at least for this movie.
For sure.
Because while this plot isn't, like, terribly groundbreaking, I think it's good to go in relatively blind to this movie. So I went in only having seen the one trailer that they released, which I thought was a phenomenal trailer, first off. I thought they marketed the movie really well, and it freaked you the fuck out, but also made you intrigued as to what the rest of the movie was going to be. And as someone who doesn't love horror movies, I appreciate that they didn't fuck with me all that much, if that makes sense. They were pretty straightforward about, like, what is supposed to be scary, what are you supposed to be freaked out by. It wasn't so much a deceit to the viewer, but a telling of a story. And that's what I enjoyed. Like, there are things in corners of rooms, which is a classic horror movie staple, but they are earned. They aren't like, holy shit, there's some weird thing there. There's an actual reason why there might be something in the corner of the room, like, staring back.
Yeah, and it's less of a, like, gonna jump out and scare you kind of thing, more like a when you see it kind of thing. And I really enjoyed that. Not a lot of jump scares in this, probably not even one. I don't know. There might have been
one. There are a couple right at the end in that last final sequence that I wouldn't call a jump scare, but they're a, like, when you notice it scare.
Yeah. It's definitely a scare.
Yeah.
But for sure, one of those movies. It's not, like you said, I wouldn't describe it as something that's, it's not like a, there aren't big twists or anything like that, that you're, I wouldn't say, like, wait till the end and wait till you see this twist at the end. It's just kind of got, like, these little plot threads that kind of throw you for loops at individual times during the movie. And that would be the reason why I wouldn't want to spoil it for anybody, not just one big thing that you can say, hey, this happens and the movie's ruined for you, which I think speaks to it as a film as well.
Yeah. I thought Toni Collette was absolutely amazing in this movie. There are scenes where it's a lot of close-ups on her face reacting to things, and she does that, I forget the name of the actress in The Shining, but that kind of, like, overly dramatic, like, melted wax face of despair. She has that and does it incredibly well. There are moments that she's reacting to anguish, and she is anguished herself, that are just gut-wrenching. And it's one of the best performances, like, full stop, that I've seen all year from any actress or actor.
Oh, it's phenomenal. And I would say, in general, the acting's really good. Obviously, she stole the show, but, I mean, you got some kids who bring it pretty hard.
Mm-hmm. So Millie Shapiro, I'm looking it up now, is Charlie, the little girl. And okay. Alex Wolff is Peter, the son. Okay. And yeah, and they're... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it was... I read somewhere that it was originally conceived as a family drama and kind of evolved into a horror film. And I really like that it has its roots in this family drama, and it's really just kind of... It keeps on that track the entire way. And the threads of horror film are in there, but mostly the horror is just, like, the things that this family has to go through.
Yeah, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the fact that Colin Stetson did all the music for this film.
Wait, before you go any further, I almost busted out laughing at the opening scene, because the music in the very opening is so aggressively Colin Stetson. I was like, are you serious? Like, is it going to be like this the whole movie? And it was just like, I'm glad it kind of chilled out.
He tones it down.
After. But, like, the first scene, I was like, oh, this sounds like an album of his.
Yeah.
Like, this whole movie just going to be his next album?
It is something that, if you don't know his music, is phenomenal. But if you do know his music, he has some very obvious cues and tendencies that he falls into. And they just explode in that first opening piece. It's the, like high arpeggios that are just fluttering over and over and over again.
I will say his circular breathing style, like with the saxophone, has a very good effect in this film. Just the kind of crescendo of that arpeggiating circular breathing, like, geez, that really builds tension.
I mean, his style itself gives me stress, because no one should be able to play a woodwind instrument for that long, that it's especially stressful to listen to him.
Especially such a deep and, like, requiring of so much breath woodwind instrument.
So when he's doing that for a film score, I think it's even better. And there were moments where there's silence, and it's deserved silence. And I thought that was really well done. But for the most part, I thought it was, you know, you kind of have these rumblings underneath all this tension and drama. And I don't know. I saw it at 10:30 a.m., which was probably pretty necessary. And I was sitting next to my friend, Christine, who... she loves horror movies, but is not good at watching them in theaters. She squirms a lot and is a little yelpy. So it was an interesting experience, to say the least, but it was definitely, definitely worth watching, and a movie I would recommend, even if you don't love horror movies.
For sure. And I definitely did this after the Quiet Place came out. Listed a few horror movies that I would recommend, but this movie is very reminiscent of, I think it borrows heavily from both The Witch and The Babadook, which are two critically acclaimed horror films. I didn't like The Witch as much as most people did, but The Babadook is phenomenal, and I would recommend that for anybody.
So on a similar note, we both saw The Incredibles 2.
I loved it.
Same. I have been waiting for, you know, what, 14 years at this point to have another Incredibles movie. We have talked about Pixar in the past. I don't know if it's on this podcast, but it's definitely been. Oh yeah, because your Coco.
It was
hot takes.
We talked a little bit about Coco, but also for the most part, our Pixar takes are on paper on our fantasy football ranking blog.
Let's not talk about that ever again. But yeah, so
embarrassed right now.
Of course. So The Incredibles was something, one of my favorite, I don't know, three Pixar movies. It's my favorite superhero movies.
I think I had it at like four or five.
It's my favorite superhero movie. Like, it's like The Dark Knight and this are my two favorite.
I was
going to
say, I think The Dark Knight is my favorite, and then maybe like Captain America, Winter Soldier.
Incredibles. But this is a damn good superhero movie.
It really is.
So going into the second one, I had high hopes, and it I wouldn't say exceeded my expectations, but it definitely met my expectations. And the thing I think I picked up most about it is it's not a kid's movie, like, at all.
Not even a little bit. I mean, no. Which is smart, because 14 years ago, how old were the people that enjoyed that movie, and how old are they now?
Yeah, like, the whole screenslaver fight sequence in the, like, middle of it.
Right before that,
yeah.
the was very reminiscent of Silence of the Lambs, with Clarice Starling going into Buffalo Bill's house,
yeah,
and being in the dark, and him having the night vision goggles.
Yeah, like, people were jumping.
I was legitimately
all around
freaked
me.
Out during that scene.
So, I mean, I was very happy they added Bob Odenkirk into the mix. I think he's a great voice actor and was pretty perfect for that role.
And they animated that character so well.
Like,
that voice goes so perfectly with that character.
The one nitpick I could have is the plot is pretty spelled out from, like, the first 15 minutes onward.
Yes.
You pretty much know exactly what's going to happen after the first opening dialogue. It's like, okay.
So, spoiler here. I'm going to spoil The Incredibles 2, so fast forward, like, 45 seconds,
yeah,
or something. Yeah. But as soon as I... So it took me a minute to figure out that Catherine Keener was the voice of, what's her name, Evelyn.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as I figured out it was Catherine Keener, I was like, wow, yeah, she's the big bad.
Yeah.
She's the one.
It was, oh, it's one of these two? Oh, no, Bob and Kirk would be too obvious. Okay, let's do Catherine Keener. So it wasn't the most...
All right, end of spoiler. End of spoiler. End of spoiler. All right, we're back.
So one thing I looked up afterwards is there's a comparison between the first Incredibles and the second Incredibles when Violet asked that guy out at the football game.
Yeah.
And the animation jump is just so incredible if you look at it side by side.
This movie, so I didn't watch the side by side, but this movie was noticeably beautifully animated. It's incredible. It's very, very, very good.
The whole Elastigirl chase scene
on the
so well done.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was a great movie. It's hard to write a movie that will make both kids and parents and 20-something-year-olds happy. But I think they nailed it. You know, it's not a 10 out of 10, but it is a movie I would greatly enjoy. I'm very happy I went and saw. It's a movie that I would have, you know, paid full price for and not been upset about. It was really well
done.
But
we didn't have to because of MoviePass.
Yeah, I'm trying not to shill them out any more than I have to. But yeah, it was a really fucking good movie, and I'm happy that they returned to that IP and did it really well.
I'm also happy that they returned to it at the same time. Like, they could have done a time jump.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big problems with time jumps is there's a lot of exposition that needs to be filled. And this movie literally picks up right where Incredibles 1 left off. And I think that was really smart.
To be fair, the first movie literally ended with, here is the next movie. It's The Underminer. So
I didn't read it that way when it happened. I was actually really surprised when I saw it open with that. I was like, I kind of thought like, oh, here's a throwaway, like one last shot of the whole family getting together to fight something.
That's fair.
So I will, just to segue a little bit into the wider Pixar universe, I think I enjoyed Incredibles 1 more as a film, but Incredibles 2 I thought was so funny. Like, it was hilarious.
Oh, when they're at the diner is one of my favorite fucking scenes.
This movie overall may be more enjoyable than the first Incredibles, though I think as a film, as an achievement, Incredibles 1 is probably better.
Yes. So my thing is, for what it did for the movie genre, I thought Incredibles 1 was way better. I mean, it's more impactful, it's more important. I don't think that Incredibles 2 is an important film, if that makes sense. But I thought that it was hilarious, well animated, engaging, never a dull moment, funny, all those positives. But
people that have
it wasn't essential.
People that have problems with sequels won't have a problem with this. One more thing that would have been a perfect segue into the next movie I wanted to talk about, but we're gonna skip that. To talk about the incredible soundtrack of Incredibles 2. Man, it's nostalgic, it's fast paced, it's just jazzy as hell. It's evocative of like old superhero cartoons. It's just perfectly done.
Yeah, it turns out Pixar makes good movies. Weird, right?
Yeah. So now to get back to the segue.
I don't think that's how segues work.
Have you ever ridden a segue? Let the record show Zach is palming his face and shaking his head. If you have problems with unnecessary sequels, Ant-Man 2 might not be your cup of tea. I was with a bunch of people who really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it. Like, it was a fun romp, but as unexpectedly good as Ant-Man 1 was, I had no designs to go see Ant-Man 1. I ended up watching it on a plane because it was the only thing on there.
It seems like a perfect plane movie.
Ended up really enjoying it. I've now seen it probably 3 or 4 times. It's just kind of just like a good, funny movie that's kind of a techno thriller heist movie. And it kind of divorces itself from the whole MCU, and it doesn't take itself too seriously, which is really nice. Ant-Man 2 was just kind of like the way that Incredibles 2 came back, got the band back together, and it seemed like it hadn't been 14 years. Ant-Man 2 made it seem like it had been 14 years, and they were trying to get the band back together and do all the same old jokes and like all that stuff. It was enjoyable, like as a watch. If you have something along the lines of MoviePass, not to show for them again, and don't have to pay a lot of money to go see it, yeah, go see it. It'll be fun. But if you're looking for like a good film to watch, nah.
Yeah, it seemed like something I wouldn't mind watching on like a Wednesday after work one day and be like, oh, I watched that. That was fine.
You haven't seen Ant-Man, right?
No.
And like, I would recommend seeing that at some point. Not like, don't go out of your way to see it, but like if it's ever on some, I think it might be streaming right now. It might be on Netflix or Amazon Prime or something. I would just say like, put it on one night and you'll enjoy it. But
yeah, that's kind of the view I have of it. Is I'm not gonna seek it out, but if it's on, or if I can go to it for free, sure. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Two movies that I would actually recommend paying to go see. First, the one I liked a little less of the two, and this is like this is a caveat because because I loved both of them, but I thought was one is like one of my favorite movies of the year. But Sorry to Bother You and First Reformed are two movies that I've seen recently that could not be more viscerally different of movies, but are both incredible achievements in their own way. So I saw Sorry to Bother You a couple weeks ago, and I was instantly drawn in by the trailer that had been in front of, you know, a bunch of the marquee movies recently. It stars Lakeith Stanfield and Tessa Thompson. It's directed by Boots Riley. It has Armie Hammer in one of his best Armie Hammer performances. And it is just as beautifully weird as you would want. It is something where I would recommend you watch the trailer and then you go into it and you don't think about anything else. You don't read any other reviews. And it makes it's a good social commentary, but it's also a good movie on its own. So go watch that if you can. It's still in theaters. It is still, you know, out wide. For First Reformed, which is a much, much different movie, I saw that over 4th of July with my, with our buddy Nate at the tiny, tiny Amherst Cinema, which holds about 25 people.
Friend of the pod.
Correct. First guest, inaugural guest.
Yeah.
With about 25 people. We saw it on July 3rd, I think. And I went in completely blind to this movie. It stars Ethan Hawke and Amanda Seyfried. And Ethan Hawke is a pastor with a rough backstory who lives in upstate New York. And
you could say he had a rough past.
No. Or... No, I can't. I absolutely cannot. Can I quit this podcast now? Is that possible? But he lives in upstate New York and works at this tiny little old school church that is in the shadow of a mega church. And he is kind of going through some internal strife, and it follows the story of him and how he's coping with all of that. And it is fucking incredible. Ethan Hawke puts on one of, if not the best performance I've seen all year. It draws you in. It's kind of Taxi Driver-esque, and it just grips you the entire movie. So I would highly, highly recommend seeing that if you can find a smaller theater that is playing it.
So I watched this trailer, I believe, back in April. It had just come out at, I think, Sundance. And the trailer reminded me tonally of You Were Never Really Here.
Yep.
And immediately I was very excited to see it. Disappointed to find that it wasn't going to be out in theaters until June or July or whatever. More disappointed to find that now that it is out in theaters, the only theater that shows it only shows it at 9:35 p.m., which...
You are old.
Pretty much is after I go to bed every night because job. But I think I'll probably have to wait until it's streaming somewhere and then watch it because doesn't seem like it's happening.
Yeah, it's a high recommend.
I was immediately after seeing that trailer really excited to see it, and then you recommended it. Of course, I don't trust you that much, but
fair.
Added a little bit to my already existing desire to see it. So yeah, it's on the list. Sorry to Bother You is for sure on the list. I'm gonna make an effort to go see that as well.
Yeah, and that's playing mostly because
I love Lakeith Stanfield so much. He's probably my favorite part of Atlanta. Ooh, wish that dude had more roles and things.
You want to have a real segue?
Sure.
So speaking of Tessa Thompson, let's talk about the end of Westworld.
Hey.
See, it actually works.
All right, are we spoiling this?
What's up?
Are we spoiling this?
No. I still think we can talk about it pretty generally. Okay. So Westworld is a show that I watch every week and I enjoy every week, but I'm frustrated by every week. And there are episodes that I think that they nail the style of really well. They did one focusing on a Native American character. I think it was episode 7 of this season. And then there are episodes that I think are just totally fucking useless and add nothing to the overall plot or style of the show. So it's very hit or miss for me. And the finale I thought was like 60% miss, 50 or 40% hit, something around there.
Yeah. It was disappointing to me, especially since, so I think I said this maybe an episode or two ago. I was at the point where, I think it was around episode 6, where I had decided Westworld is a bad show, but I'm still going to hate watch it just because I've already invested that much time in it. And then they came back with 3 pretty incredible episodes that either advanced the plot or went deep on something that I wasn't expecting. And then to finish with that finale was
so cluttered.
It was like, I wish I could say it was so close, like, to being good, but it wasn't. It literally, they could have cut out like an hour of film from that episode and had a really good half hour episode that ended the season pretty tightly. But I mean, I'm gonna watch it again when it comes on, probably next year, whatever it does. I'm still invested in it. I feel like it still has a lot to say, and without spoiling anything, I feel like the way that it left off season 2 sets up well for a clean slate in season 3, where they can really do whatever they want with it. And
it just depends on whether it's what we want to watch for season 3.
Exactly. And I think we've made it pretty clear, like, what we want from this show. And I don't know if that's what the creators want from the show. I think they like playing games with Reddit. And that's not where I want to be, like, watching a show.
So I watched The Leftovers recently, which comes highly recommended from friend of the pod, Nate Munshine. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Who?
But it was a show that started off pretty rocky in the first season. There were parts of the first season that I loved and parts that were super frustrating. To give a like 2-sentence synopsis of the show, on October 14th, 2% of the world's population suddenly disappears, and then the show picks up 3 years later dealing with the aftermath and the social issues that have sprung up after that. And it's a show that is great in theory, took a little while to understand what it was, but in seasons 2 and 3 kind of figured out what was important to it and what characters were important and what themes were important. And played with the kind of supernatural, ununderstandable mindset really, really well. And going from, like, watching all of Westworld to then watching all of The Leftovers, I see the kind of faults of them in Leftovers Season 1 in Westworld Season 2 that they fixed, and I hope that Westworld can fix them.
Yeah, so one of my main sticking points in Westworld was that the acting was phenomenal. So I'm still going to stick around to see what these talented people can do. But at a certain point, the dialogue got so ridiculous that no actor could act themselves out of that wet paper bag.
It's so bad. It was so bad.
So that draw kind of... Yeah, that dissipated a little bit, but I'm hoping for that reason that they come back in season 3 and are able to give these really talented people something to work with. And for sure, I would like to watch The Leftovers and then get that contrast.
Without spoiling anything, the acting job that Tessa Thompson did in the last few episodes was fucking incredible in Westworld.
Yeah, pretty crazy. I don't know if I can make this segue without spoiling anything, so I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. If you like Westworld, keep watching Westworld. If you have given up before, I don't think there's been much to bring you back in.
Yeah, like if you watched Westworld and were disappointed and gave up, go watch Barry.
It's better.
So I was going to make a segue to Twin Peaks The Return. Those who have watched both Westworld and Twin Peaks The Return will understand the segue, but been watching this for a while. It's not something you can binge. It's something that you have to watch one episode at a time, once a week or so, because it takes that much time to digest. It's just really interesting that Showtime gave David Lynch this leash to do whatever the hell he wanted with this season of Twin Peaks. And if you haven't watched the original two seasons of Twin Peaks, absolutely full recommend. It's this weird, like, melodrama in a small town in Washington with all sorts of weird supernatural stuff going on. Some of the best television I've ever watched.
It's been on my list for a while. I just haven't gotten into it for whatever reason.
It's same. It was on my list for a while, and then last year I finally got around to watching it, and I watched it myself and then rewatched it with my roommate, and now we're watching Twin Peaks The Return together, and it's wildly different. Picks up 25 years after the conclusion of the first two seasons of Twin Peaks, and kind of just runs with the whole supernatural element in the original Twin Peaks. And basically David Lynch makes this art film surrounded by like weird cop drama, and it's at times a tough hang, but I mean, if you can appreciate it, you can appreciate it. And I mean, the acting is really good. You get to see Laura Dern say fuck you to everybody a lot. There's a
so super right up your alley.
There's a super cut of her saying fuck you on YouTube that that I really enjoy. Yeah, my queen and my president, Laura Dern. It also spawned one of my favorite pictures of all time, which is David Lynch sitting on a bench next to a cow smoking a cigarette with a billboard that just says Laura Dern on it. yeah, I mean, honestly, like, a lot of it is phenomenal filmmaking, and it's a lot of disparate threads that I hope at some point come together. I've got like 6 or 7 episodes left. But I mean, you can enjoy it for what it is. It has some really weird cameos and weird parts. I texted this to both you and Nate at one point. I was literally watching this show and said out loud, thank God Jim Belushi's here to make sense of all of this, with no sarcasm whatsoever.
Of course.
Yeah, it's very interesting. If you're into just weird shit, I would say, yeah, Twin Peaks The Return. But definitely the first two seasons of Twin Peaks are a must.
So another show that I think we're both pretty excited for that's coming back, not this weekend, but the next weekend, is Better Call Saul. I don't think there's much to preview from this. I think it is an incredible character drama in the world of a real drama, which is two things that I absolutely love. I'm a real sucker for a properly well-done character drama.
Mad Men,
specifically. And I think that they had such a heart... who's the fucking creator of Better Call Saul? What's his name?
Vince Gilligan.
Vince Gilligan. Yeah. So I think he had such a hard time crafting this world, which was adjacent to Breaking Bad and dealt with Breaking Bad, but wasn't going to be overshadowed with it at all times. And so the characters of Jimmy, Kim, and Jimmy's Chuck. Brother, Chuck. I was like, I know Michael McKean, but I can't think of his character's name. I think the world that they created in there is such a triumph and so incredibly difficult to do that they've pulled it off for 3 seasons, and from everything that's been released so far, gets even better in the 4th season.
Not to get real douchey about it, but the location of New Mexico is such a beautiful blank slate upon which to paint that I'm so glad they revisited it for this little spinoff. But to me, Better Call Saul has become almost as good as Breaking Bad, which is insane to me because Breaking Bad is one of, if not my favorite show of all time. It treats the minutiae of everyday lawyer life as if it is the most dramatic thing in the world. And yeah. It is compelling, and it's somehow as dramatic as meth dealing.
Yeah, and shout out to Jonathan Banks, too, who's been holding down the Mike Ehrmantraut role for so long.
God, I love him so much.
Who plays Kim? What's her name?
Rhea Seahorn.
Rhea Seahorn. She is so fucking good in this series.
She's a glue person. She holds a lot of the threads together.
Yeah, it's an incredible show. I'm so happy for it to be returning, and it's one of the few shows that I will like appointment watch on a Sunday night.
Yeah, so. We talked about Overlooked a little bit, and I think because it's been overshadowed by Breaking Bad, it kind of has been forgotten a little bit. And we're going on season 4 here. Like, this is a full-on show. It's by the end of this season, it will be one season short of how long Breaking Bad was. And it really stands on its own well.
It is overlooked in the fact that it doesn't get the same viewers, but it's critically acclaimed, and I feel like that discrepancy is always tough to deal with, where critics love it, critics praise it, but no one watches it. That's kind of how The Leftovers was.
It is reassuring, though, that we know that this show is going to be around just because of the cachet it has, because of Vince Gilligan and its critical acclaim. Mm-hmm. So we're not worried about this show being canceled and never resolving or anything like that. Plus, this show has so many places it can go because it is kind of simultaneously both a prequel and a sequel in part. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to see what this transition between past, present, and future is like and how far it goes.
So on the podcast, The Watch, Andy Greenwald and Chris Ryan talk about this kind of thing of penning yourself in by doing prequels over and over. And they said that Better Call Saul did something great, showing that there is a world outside of the world that you know. So it is a true and true prequel, but we're at least thinking about the outside the entire time that we're watching the show. And I think that's really important. Like, yeah. We don't know what's going to happen with Kim. She's not in Breaking Bad. That's very clear. But we don't know if a good thing happens to her, a bad thing happens to her, because we know that there's a life at the end that exists outside of Breaking Bad.
For sure. And I fully agree with what you just said. A lot of the problems with prequels we've talked about, Solo, it is that we know what happens to these characters, which is a problem that I think the Amazon show about Aragorn is going to have. But Better Call Saul has done such a good job of making us care about these secondary and tertiary characters that we don't really care about the end game as much, more just, all right, what's going to happen next with these characters?
It's such a good show, and I'm very excited for it to come back. That's all I can say at this point.
Honestly, I'm going to go back and rewatch some season one and season two, because a lot of that stuff's not as fresh as I would like it to be.
Sam, it's worth it. You want to touch on some music real quick before we go into our overlooked category?
Why the hell not?
Sure. So actually, we took a decent hiatus between our last two podcasts, but not a ton of music has come out in that time. The only one that I would say that I am like, excuse me, the only two that I would say that I'm genuinely excited about are the Rolling Blackout Coastal Fever and the Kamasi Washington albums.
Yeah.
You turned me on to Rolling Blackout Coastal Fever, didn't you?
Which I heard on the Watch, previously mentioned podcast with Andy Grunewald and Chris Ryan. They played an in-studio version of their song Talking Straight, and I instantly fell in love. I heard that song and I was like, this is like a surfer version of like a Ramones song, and it was the perfect vibe that I wanted at that moment. Summer was just about to turn over, and I was looking for something to listen to in my car with the windows down, driving to and from work, driving to the beach, and I've talked about this before on the podcast, but I think one of the most important things that an album can do is create an aesthetic, and this has aesthetic coming out of its eyes. It's so good. It's an Australian band, and they play distilling it to surfer music would be a disservice to it, but it's kind of punky, kind of like alternative rocky. Got a lot of different influences, but it's kind of its own thing.
I, after listening to the album and listening to it a few times, looked up if they were playing in New York. I immediately bought two tickets. I don't have anyone to go with me, but I have two tickets. So,
hey, somebody hit up Zach. Anybody listening, hit up Zach for a free
ticket. No. Come on now.
For a face value ticket to Rolling Blackout's Coastal Fever.
No, they're a band that it's a genre that I don't often find albums that I love. I often find albums that I like in this kind of indie rock, indie pop rock kind of genre. And this one I thought stuck with me a lot more. Talking Straight is going to be one of my favorite songs of the year. I think it's an incredibly crafted pop song. Yeah. No, pop rock song. I don't know. Whatever you want to call it. I'm bad with genres.
Genres are bad in general.
Well, yeah, I would highly recommend listening. It's called Hope Dawns? Hope Downs?
Something like that. Album? I'm bad with
albums. We should probably get this right.
It took me a solid like 15 seconds to come up with the Casey Musgraves album title when you put me on the spot in that episode. So I'm not
Hope. It is Hope Downs officially.
Hope Downs. Yeah, I was gonna. If I had to choose between the two, I would have picked that one. I've been throwing this album in a playlist with Courtney Barnett's album of like a little Australian like heading to the beach music, and it's been pretty dope.
Of course, you can't let those Aussies away from each other. The other album that I've enjoyed from this past couple weeks is the new Kamasi Washington album. I feel like if you listen to the epic, you kind of know what's going to happen in this one. It's going to be a elongated solo heavy jazz album that is masturbatory, but not in a overly terrible way. It's beautiful. He has his own voice. I think he's kind of the worst soloist out of everyone. Kamasi is a band leader. but it's a jazz album that you can kind of throw on and work to or listen to while you're commuting or anything like that, and it's well worth a long listen.
Yeah, that's generally how I listen to jazz until I fully absorb it to the point where I want to, like, focus listen on it. These types of albums are really tough to do that because 3 hours and 2.5 hours, you can't just, like, sit down and focus on something like that for that long. But Kamasi's just very interesting artist. He has so many different influences. He's theatrical. He's at times virtuosic, but like you said, he's probably not even the best soloist in his band. I mean, there are hints of influences from classic jazz artists like John Coltrane, and that's something that I appreciate, but his best work is stuff that is new and unique to him. He has some weird, like, video game style sounding music at times. He's got a lot of Latin influences. And like I said, theatrical stuff, very, like, cabaret style music. It's going back to genre just being bad. Like, why be contained into one thing? It's way more boring to listen to an album if you know every song is going to sound very similar, especially with a jazz album. And the way he can adventure and still make it sound cohesive is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I don't normally listen to couple hour long jazz albums, but this is one that I will make an exception for. A couple hour long album that I will not make an exception for is Drake's new album, which I listened to once in full, liked about 2 or 3 songs, and just gave up on immediately. I have liked Drake's stuff in the past, but this is just kind of, you know, one bridge too far. I can't get behind the super long double album when you have nothing to say. It was just very boring.
Yeah, I didn't listen to it.
I listened to it one time.
The way I generally listen to Drake is the way you described how you listen to this album. I listen to his albums maybe like 6 months to a year after he releases them, and I'll cruise through it really quickly to pick out songs for my, like, best of hip-hop playlist, and I usually pick out, like, somewhere between 2 and 5 songs. This one sounds like I'll be picking off 2 out of whatever 26 songs. He's immensely popular, which is a gift and a curse to him. I feel like he has so much talent, but he feels like he has to pander to a group of people in order to stay popular for some reason. I don't know. But
his last few albums have not been great.
For the most part, I don't enjoy him.
I really enjoy If You're Reading This Now, It's Too Late. I think it's his best album by a considerable amount, but I don't know.
That was one that I pulled like 4 or 5 songs off of, but I think you enjoyed that album in its entirety more than I did.
Probably. It was still too long.
I don't like singing Drake as much as most people do.
Fair. Let's touch on a few things very quickly. We both thought the Carters album was fine. I don't really
think
I
had anything. Listen to it.
I listened to it one time through. I got bored really easily. Beyonce was so much better on it than Jay-Z was, and she wasn't
even
great.
Jay-Z is dead. I haven't heard a good Jay-Z verse in years, so Jay-Z's dead. I go back and I listen to, like, early 90s Jay-Z, and I'm just sad. Like, this guy used to be the best rapper in the world, for real, and now he's out just love. I don't get enough of it.
That's still my favorite verse of all time. I really liked the new Death Grips album. I'm going to give one sentence on it because I know you don't care at all. I liked it. Listen to it. It's great. An album I did not care for at all was the new Chromeo album. There's been a weird thing between the both of us where there's a band that we like a lot until we immediately dislike them.
Mine was Fits in the Tantrums.
Yep, I was literally going to say Fits in the Tantrums. We saw them at Bonnaroo really close, right up front, and they were super fun. And then we...
That was perhaps like one of my top three favorite shows we saw at that Bonnaroo. And immediately after, they came out with a new album, and it was just trash.
It's incredible how a couple bands like that can fall. Like, I'll be honest, I really like Matt and Kim's first release. Not all of it, but like Daylight was fun, and it was back in like the early college days. And then as soon as they released something else, I was like, oh no, I hate this. This is like really bad. So yeah, the new Chromeo album, not worth listening to. Do you want to go on to our overlooked movies and music right now?
Let's touch briefly on J-Rock.
Okay, go for it.
So, J-Rock, we haven't done this yet, but I think we have designs of doing like a tiers of our favorite hip-hop artists. Hip-hop's such a rich and deep genre right now that, I mean, we could talk for probably hours. hours. About our favorite hip hop artists. Yeah, I know. I get really emotional about it. But I would put J-Rock in that tier with like Freddie Gibbs and Big Crit, though probably below both of those guys in terms of my enjoyment of them. I think he's talented. He's not as deft lyrically as those two. Maybe doesn't have as smooth of a flow as them, but I think he's more consistent in general. Like those two guys have really high highs. J-Rock is pretty steady. I don't know if that's how you feel about him though.
I like him as a guest a lot. I don't love Money him Trees. On his own stuff. Money Trees is such a good song. Like, so I enjoy the song Win, but it's not a good song. Like, I know it's not a good song, and I'm aware it's not a good song, but I like the song. Money Trees is great. He does really well on some of the Posse tracks.
Vice City
is so good.
Minus Absol. All
right, if there's something that this podcast can, like, center around, it's the fact that Chris and I both think that Absol is absolute fucking garbage. And I think that there is nothing that we have agreed on more in our entire lives than that.
So I was at that show with, it was like Absol, J-Rock, Schoolboy Q, Kendrick, SZA, and we were tailgating like before the show, and we could hear that someone had come on, and we were hanging out with these two people that were just like randoms. They came over to our truck bed to like throw some beers in our cooler and just be like, hey, you guys look cool. Like, mind if we put our beers in your cooler? So we're hanging out with these two people, and like music had clearly come on, and they were like, oh shit, we should probably go. And I was like, nah, don't worry about it. It's Absol. And this guy was like, oh, I love Absol. And I was like, all right, yeah, you go ahead. I don't want to talk to you anymore.
You can leave. Yeah, Absol is pretty like unequivocally terrible. So,
yeah, still pretty broken up that he was given the most verses on any song on the Black Panther soundtrack.
Ugh. All right, let's move away from this quick because it's making me upset. Right. So do you want to touch on the movies first or music first? I don't know how you're feeling. I feel like movies we can actually dialogue about a little bit, and then music is more just recommendations.
Let's do movies first and then do quick recommendations at the end.
All right, you want to start with your movies?
Yeah, I'll start with... So, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. It's a Ben Stiller movie. Mediocre.
One of the great dramatic actor of our times.
Yeah, for sure. This is a movie that I have watched more than probably any other film over the past 3 or 4 years, aside from just like randomly watching bits and pieces of Jurassic Park and Jaws on TV. Immediately made me want to go visit Iceland. It's one of the most beautifully shot films I've seen in a long time. I saw this in Grand Budapest Hotel right around the same time, and those movies are kind of linked inextricably in my mind now, just based on like aesthetically how they made me feel, like just beautifully shot films. And while it's not an original or super compelling plot, it's just a really good adventure story, and it's just a feel good, like an interesting, it's this guy who spends his entire life in an office and zones out a lot and creates these like personal dreams in his head, and he goes on adventures and stuff, and then something bad happens at work and he has to go on a real adventure, and it's an interesting story about how he merges his real life with the life in his head.
And it's something that I have meant to watch for a long time but never just gotten around to.
There's something about it that just like it draws me to it personally, and I fully understand that it's not necessarily for everybody. Like, people might think it's cheesy or whatever, but I love it. Has some really good comedic turns by some co-stars. Like, Adam Scott plays this like evil boss with a ridiculous beard.
Adam Scott is weirdly good at about being evil.
Yeah. Catherine Hahn plays the sister. It's got a good supporting cast. Kristen Wiig plays the love interest. It's very, very, very good.
Do you want to keep going with yours, or do you want me to go to mine?
I can keep going.
Keep going.
So my second one is Dope, a 2015 coming-of-age film about a kid who grows up in a really not nice neighborhood, but he's clearly very smart and going places. It's this push and pull between his environment and where he's going, and he kind of inadvertently gets stuck in this, turns into like a weird chase/heist film, and wasn't at all what I was expecting. It has really weird cameos from A$AP Rocky and Vince Staples and Tyga. I just got to see it. It's one of the, like, I don't want to say too much about it because it's just entirely unexpected. I would say kind of a weird parallel would be Superbad. It's just one of those, like,
gotcha.
We're going to follow this kid in high school, and just like a lot of shit goes wrong in a really hilarious way, but it's treated with a lot more seriousness than Superbad. And
makes sense.
It's heartfelt and funny, and it, I would say, important.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And my third is The Nice Guys. Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling. Had no expectations for this movie whatsoever. It's about a private investigator, and well, a girl goes missing, and I think it's two private investigators. I think they're both private investigators, and one of them is investigating the other as a potential like kidnapper or something like that, and they kind of end up hooking up and like tag teaming the investigation and trying to find this girl, and it leads them in hilarious places. Just comes off as like a buddy cop film, but it's like criminal buddy cops.
Synopses of comedy films are never as good as the actual films themselves.
No, of course not. I believe it takes place in the 70s, so it's very like period piece. It's 70s LA, so it has that kind of like weird nostalgia associated with it too. So just creates an aesthetic, which is important to me. And it's also hilarious.
Fair. I've never seen either of those three. I'm probably going to see those in order. Walter Mitty first, Dope second, and Nice Guys third.
That's the order I would put them in as well. I think just for, like, an every person's, like, who I would suggest everybody see, I would say probably in the order of Dope, Secret Life, and then Nice Guys. But for you, see The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, because you're my friend, and you should watch movies that are my favorite movies.
That's the nicest thing you've ever said to me. For me, I have one movie that's kind of in the zone I think should have been reviewed better, and then I have two movies that were reviewed very well, but I think should have gotten a lot more acclaim than they actually were. So I think Drinking Buddies, the movie with Olivia Wilde, Anna Kendrick, the guy from Office Space, I forget his name, and I think Nick Johnson, it's one of the mumblecore movies where there's a very loose script based around a plot that the characters and actors kind of have to improvise their lines, and it feels a lot more natural. So basically the entire plot of this movie is there are two coworkers who work at a brewery together that kind of have a very close and flirtatious relationship, and they go on a vacation together with both of their significant others, and it's kind of their lives after that. It's a movie that I can see a lot of people not enjoying because not a ton happens, but as mentioned before, I am one who greatly enjoys character dramas, so the kind of interaction between everyone and the choices that everyone tries to make and is flawed are all really, really intriguing and intricate points. And it got, like, very, very moderate reviews when it came out. But it's a movie that when I look back on it and listen to it again and watch it again, it has a real impact. And it's something that, Chris, I think you should definitely watch.
Sounds good.
The other one that got very well reviewed, but I think should have gotten a little bit more notoriety, is Foxcatcher with Steve Carell and Channing Tatum and Mark Ruffalo. So going to school in Delaware, you hear about the DuPont family all the time. And this story has been kind of, you know, everyone has heard about it. But seeing a comedic actor do this role in this way and see Channing Tatum, who was this before, I don't know if this was before or after Magic Mike, but it was before he was like a really well-known serious actor. I thought it was phenomenal. I was gripped. Steve Carell did an incredible job, and it's a movie that I think was given its praise in its time and then forgotten about immediately.
I think just to speak to that point, I saw it in theaters, really enjoyed it, recommended to a bunch of people, including my roommates. We had it on our DVR for a while, and then it just got deleted because we never watched it.
Yeah, people forgot about it just about immediately.
Forget about, though, was Mark Ruffalo's walk.
Oh, yeah.
He walked the hell out of that movie.
He killed that beard. And the last one, which is probably my most egregious inclusion, because it was very popular, got nominated for a bunch of stuff, but again, I still feel is underappreciated for what it accomplished, is Her, the Joaquin Phoenix and Scarlett Johansson movie. Her. This is one of my favorite films of the past decade. I think it captured a mindset and a style better than anything I've seen in a long time. Joaquin Phoenix is probably my favorite actor at the moment, considering what he's done with Her, You Were Never Really Here, The Master, Inherent Vice, all those incredible movies. And it is a story that the plot could have gone really wrong really quickly had they not treated it as not the first human to interact with computers in this way, but as a human interacting with computers that is unsure of himself in a world where this is developing. And it gets some great, great supporting roles from Olivia Wilde and Amy Adams.
Two of my favorites.
And Chris Pratt is in it as well.
Really?
And it is just such a well-crafted movie. Spike Jonze has this vision of a modern L.A., and you can kind of feel the future as a positive rather than a negative, which is really tough to come by in a lot of new movies. The future is just this sad place where everyone dies and is gray and is gross. And in this movie, the future is like pastel pink and has mustaches, and everyone lives in high-rise buildings with weird high-waisted pants, you know? It was a view of the future that was necessary and new, that was just acted the fucking hell out of.
I never revisited it, mostly because it made me thoroughly uncomfortable, but I'm sure that was most of the point of it. But it also made me laugh harder than many other movies of the genre.
When Joaquin Phoenix is playing video games with Scarlett Johansson, quote unquote, over his shoulder, and Spike Jonze voicing the NPCs in the game, it's so good. It's so good. The last little shout out I'll give, which is not to a theatrical movie, but the Nick Cave movie, One More Time with Feeling, is a half concert film, half documentary about making an album after the death of his son, and it is shot and dealt with in such a beautiful way that I cannot afford to not give it a mention. So definitely look at that.
Yeah, I'm probably gonna skip that just for, you know, my heart's sake.
It's so good. It is so good.
Zach, you haven't seen how much I cry at Coco. Imagine this one.
It is one of the most depressing things, but in a very earned way. If that makes sense.
For those playing the drinking game, we've said earned like four times this podcast.
We should start a drinking game.
People would definitely listen to our podcast more if there was a drinking game associated with it.
Couldn't listen to it less. All right. You want to give your couple of recommendations?
Yeah, just to preface, I'm going to cheat like three times during this little segment, but we invented it, so who cares? To start, I'm going to go with the album Tied to a Star by our hometown hero, Jay Maskus.
With his salt and pepper locks.
Anytime Zach and I are home and see this man at the High Horse or the Taste of Amherst or whatever frozen yogurt place he's getting frozen yogurt at, we don't bother him, but we nod knowingly to each other and have a conversation about how starstruck we were later. Jay Maskus is probably the guitarist I wish I could be. He has an incredible ability to both create incredibly melodic finger-picking riffs and these just like fuzz-filled solos. Wouldn't even know where to start in terms of classifying this album, but it's very folky, it's rocky, it's just awesome. But I own this one on vinyl. I only own albums on vinyl that I can listen to front to back without any inhibitions, and I feel like any Jay Maskus album is probably going to be overlooked just because he's better known.
No one knows him.
Better known for Dinosaur Jr. And even Dinosaur Jr. mostly had its heyday in the 90s. So
that is fair.
This particular album is my favorite of his, just based on listenability all the way through and just repeatable riffs, and it's just awesome, and I revisit it all the time.
In a similar situation, my first album is a EP by John Frusciante, best known for his time with the Red Hot Chili Peppers as their main guitarist for, you know, most of their biggest albums. It is the Letter Lefier EP. I forget exactly when it came out. I think it's
somewhere 2013. Around, like,
yeah. 2012, 2013. And it's only 5 songs, and it's maybe less than 20 minutes. But it is this weird breakbeat infused chaos that breaks out into these impressively beautiful moments. And from an artist that I listened to for so long that would make these, you know, not basic pop songs, but like regular rock, indie rock pop songs, to have this weird, uncomfortable, bizarre EP in the middle of all that, or at the end of all that, I could not love it more. It is weird, it is not for everyone, but it is so fucking good.
Yeah, I just to branch off of that a little bit, I enjoy a lot of his solo stuff, and that album's good. I just don't revisit it a whole lot. The one that I go back to is the instrumental album he did with Omar Rodriguez Lopez. And before I even saw that you had that in your underappreciated albums, I thought about including that one. And then I saw it and I was like, nah, I can't. That's too much.
Can't double up.
Yeah.
All right, so what's your next one?
So my second one is Love Iron Song by Frank Turner. I feel like he's been getting a little more notoriety over the past 3 to 5 years, which isn't necessarily good for his musical direction. I'm not a huge fan of a lot of the stuff he's been coming out with lately, but his album Love Iron Song is a lyrical pinnacle. It's just storytelling at its peak, and every single song is just dripping with effort and heart. And it's also not for everyone, just because not everyone loves folk punk.
Fair. I feel like that's a fair assessment.
He describes himself as a skinny, half-assed English country singer. Wouldn't describe him as country at all, but definitely a lot of folk influences, definitely a lot of punk influences. What I will say about him is that his live shows are always fun. I've seen him 4 or 5 times now. But if anybody has any inkling to listen to something that is just lyrically heartfelt and interesting, I would suggest Love Iron Song.
My next one is Impossible Truth by William Tyler. William Tyler is a guitarist who puts out instrumental albums that are somewhere in the border of Americana / folk / country, that are usually played with a minimal but full band. And this is the kind of music I will put on to drive to work on, to like deal with a difficult subway commute. He's an incredible finger pick guitarist. So he can create melodies and harmonies and these intricate through lines with just his own guitar. And it's some of the most calming music I've ever listened to.
So whenever I listen to William Tyler, I imagine driving through either like a desert wasteland on the highway or driving through like the hills of Scotland.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible how easily his music transports you somewhere else. I don't know. For me, it's like driving through, you know, rural Iowa. These, like, you know, cornfields over and over and over again. And it is just so incredibly calming but interesting. It's something that you can both listen to or kind of have on the background at the same time. Both would be equally as interesting. And it's just one of my favorite albums that I've heard in a very long time that can serve such a versatile purpose.
So I was at the Frist Art Museum in Nashville, Tennessee on this road trip with my mom last September. And they had a weird, like, video exhibit going on where some of the videos had music associated with them. And one of them was a William Tyler song, and I was very pleased to hear that. And it was one of his, like, 9-minute tracks.
Yeah.
And I stood there for the whole thing and listened to it. It was pretty awesome.
That's perfect. All right, what's your last one?
So I'm going to cheat here.
Of course.
I'm going to go with two. And neither one of them is an album. The first one is Static Selecta as an artist, because I don't really enjoy any of his albums in their entirety, so I feel weird like recommending an album if I don't like it. He's a hip-hop producer who works with a lot of different hip-hop artists. Among his frequent collaborators are Joey Badass, Big Crit, Royce the 5'9", Black Thought from The Roots. He crafts these incredible jazzy beats and has very talented artists come on the tracks. And I feel like if you put together a playlist of like his best 10 tracks, it would be a really great album. So I would suggest at least diving in, and like you can see from like who is on the track how good it's gonna be. Like most of his beats are pretty good, but if you see like trash rappers on some of his beats, you just skip that one.
Like Absol?
I don't know if he's on any of those, but yeah, for sure. And my other little compilation would be Arctic Monkeys B-sides. I feel like not a lot of people know how good the B-sides of all the Arctic Monkeys singles are, going all the way back to their first album. You could craft a pretty solid like 14 to 16 song album out of their B-sides.
You are way more into the Arctic Monkeys than I am, so I want you to kind of make me a playlist with those, and
I'm going to.
I want to see for myself. You're not going to do that.
No, I am. I actually planned on doing this.
So my last one is the Julia Holter album, Have You in My Wilderness. It is this kind of Baroque pop singer-songwriter album that came out a couple years ago that really has been something I've listened to front to back many, many times over. And she kind of crafted this album in such a way where there's never a dull moment within it. And it's quiet, but can be commanding at the same time. And it's just a really impressive composition of an album. And I keep going back to it over and over, and not just listening to a song or two that I usually do when I go back and listen to a song from years ago. I end up just listening to the album all the way through. So I'd definitely recommend doing the entire album of Julia Holter's Have You in My Wilderness. It is just incredible.
So I fall into that former category that you mentioned of going back and listening to one song. I'll have to revisit the whole album, but Sea Calls Me Home is an incredible song, and I always go back to that one.
Yeah, I mean, the entire album is well worth a listen. So the other thing I'll cheat on is the album A Shut-In's Prayer by the artist Advanced Bass. It is a single dude with a single kind of Casio keyboard. And it sounds kind of morose the entire time, but for whatever reason, it captivates me. and is something that I know isn't that great technically, but sticks to my ribs more than it should. So, A Shut-In's Prayer by Advanced Bass.
Yeah, I mean, you recently texted me asking if you should buy a ticket to his show between two shows that you're already going to on opposing days, so that would make you...
I'm probably gonna buy that show.
Do it just so that this podcast can be the podcast that does three shows in a row.
That is fair. That is definitely fair. I think we covered about everything here.
Yeah, I mean, we could probably talk for another 6 or 7 hours, but I don't know if anyone would want to listen to that.
I wouldn't even want to listen to that. So homework for each other for next show. Watch The Leftovers. I think you'd really enjoy it.
By next show?
Yes, by next show. in general, watch The Leftovers. I think you'd really enjoy it. And if you can possibly do it, try and find a way to see First Reformed.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think I'm going to have to wait on that. But if I can get to it on a weekend, maybe. But I'm on vacation a week from Friday.
You're not going to see it on your vacation?
Probably not.
How could you? All right, what's mine?
Your homework. Watch Secret Life of Walter Mitty.
Okay, easy enough.
And maybe long-term homework, watch Twin Peaks.
Yes, that is the more pressing one. I need to get on that. So, all right. Good time talking to you, and the first time in, what, 4.5 months?
Yeah, it's been forever. Yeah, we don't talk unless it's on this podcast, so don't want to waste good content.
Well, we clearly didn't have any good content here, so...
All right, everybody, thanks for listening. By the way, I don't know if you probably got a text as well, but Kathy started listening to this and wants to be on it.
Deal. She is welcome at any time.
So yeah, let's get... We've been trying to get like Dave and Kapil on for a while. Find something for them to do. Give them some homework.
We have friends, we swear.
Yeah. Patty wants to do a Pixar episode.
We got so much content lined up.
So much content lined up, so little time to do it. Stay tuned, everybody. Episode 8. See ya.
Can I say one parting word?
Fucking fine.
Can you burn that fucking hat, please?
No. I got this for free at a Padres game 3 years ago.
Fuck off.
And I'm just going to keep it forever. It's right. It's made out of 100% paper.
That seems very flammable.